Hey, Brendan.
Good day, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is up and going for episode 207. We are happily recording on our way to, what's our next milestone? 216. The arbitrary number of 216. Is that one more than the number of episodes of Stargate SG-1, or is that even with it?
I believe that's one more.
Okay.
I'll have to double check the math on that.
We have some time.
We have to decide whether we want to count their TV movies that they finished up with. I don't count those, even though they didn't finish the actual plot during the run of the series. I don't know. We got time.
Yeah, we got plenty of time. If you would like to join us for any of those episodes on the way to 216 or even the ones after that, please... feel free to contact us, let us know, tweet at us, Facebook us, hit us up in the hallway, whatever. We're happy to have guests on the air. It's a thing to be on the show, and it's great to have you on the show again. Not that we weren't on the show last week, but it's just nice. You know, I was thinking just this morning, you know, we're above, you know, 200 episodes, which is a lot of crazy episodes. That's four. We were thinking it was over 4 years of programming for these things and everything, and I realize I definitely surpassed the number of radio shows that I had when I was at the radio station in college. Because even if I had a show every week, which I know I didn't, it would have been something like 150 shows. So I'm clearly beyond the amount of time for that. That's a lot. Now, most of those shows were more than an hour long, so I don't have the math for amount of time, but it's really quality, not quantity. So that's, let's not get too caught up in how that works. But
Dr. Zoidberg says, why not both?
Indeed. Yeah, we're still up and running, and it's still surprising to a few folks when I tell them how many episodes we've done, and then I immediately follow it up with like, so why haven't you been on an episode? So we might get a few more in the coming weeks, but if you'd like to join us, feel free. If you'd like to let us know what's a thing, we'd love to talk about it on the show. It's still really fun to do the show, and you don't have to be physically with us. I mean, even Brennan and I are not physically with each other through the power of the internet.
You must be physically with us in that you yourself are corporeal.
Yes, yes.
I won't have any ghosts on my show.
Strong words for the show right after Halloween.
I draw the line there. I ain't afraid no ghosts, but I also don't want any ghosts.
Indeed. Well, we're going to start the episode with stuff that you can't see or hear. It's probably not corporeal, but it isn't ghosts. It's the sound of ads.
That's worse than ghosts.
It's worse than ghosts. So some companies have figured out that you can use ultrasound. So sounds that have a higher frequency than humans can hear. If you use, you can use ultrasound to have devices talk to each other, to send information back and forth. And their use case for this would be like if you're watching TV, and what they could do is they could, if you're the kind of person like a lot of people who have, you know, an iPad or an iPhone or whatever device you have out at the same time as you're watching TV, it could pop an ad up on the screen. And then using ultrasound, push that ad to your device as well. So you wouldn't hear it, but then all of a sudden you would get an ad that is it's at the same time as what would be on the screen or related to something on the screen. It could be done like as a product placement thing or whatever. This is not a thing. Let's just, point that out right off the bat. This came up because there was some talk to have companies that, or rather products that could talk to each other, cross-device kind of collaboration. I think the word collusion is more appropriate. It has a generally negative, more negative connotation. But what they would do is have the devices talk to each other in order to send information back and forth or time things at the same time. And I've heard of these kinds of things, like you can synchronize your, like the app to the show that you're watching, and it would pop up information that would be pertinent to the show. And I feel like that's an interesting use of it. But there was talk of the devices doing this even when the devices were off, as a way to, or asleep or locked or, essentially not being used. So as a way to, pass notifications up, you know, you're getting pop-up ads while your phone is off, and that's not a thing.
No.
So I think it is a, it's an interesting, level of communication. It certainly can be used for good, but it seems like the companies that are most interested in it want to use it for ads, which I think is a valid thing to want, but there's also no regulations or thought about it or anything, and it's probably going to be used for bad more than it's used for good, is my guess on how that works. I do like the synchronization with TV thing, the two-screen experience, as it's sometimes called. But I find that it's not that useful. It's just more distracting, honestly. I'm old enough to remember when MTV used to do pop-up video, and they would pop up things on the screen related to the music video that was kind of like fun trivia facts. And that was sort of interesting, but maybe not interesting enough to want to, you know, watch something, you know, on two screens at once. Usually that second screen, I'm not looking up anything related to what's on screen, unless it's like, oh, who's that guy? Where's he from? And then I'll look it up on IMDb. And then I'll be done. I don't need a continuous channel of IMDb or something like that. Although I think Amazon Prime does that. Have you ever seen that? It's called like Ultraviolet, I think is what they call it. Not related to the really bad movie with Mia Jovovich. But
I have not seen that.
So what happens is it's just like that. You would press like a button while it was playing, and then it would tell you, it would have this running tally at the bottom of clickable links if you were watching it on a device that you could click with, not a TV, but it would show who's in the scene, so you could click on any of those names and it would pop up their IMDb page in like a overlay, so it didn't block all of the screen. And then there were also like behind the scenes snippets of things, but it would all just, you know, be hidden if you weren't clicking anywhere on the screen. It's sort of interesting, and I think it's a way to bring back some of that, like the DVD special features that that don't exist anymore if you're streaming a video. I think that's sort of novel. It might be more useful on a second device, but you know, I think using ultrasound to do signaling between devices, I just think that it's just a little dirty. I think that's fine if you're opting in. Again, if it's being used to make more notifications, that's not good. I don't need more notifications in my life.
No, unsubscribe and kill it with fire.
Yes. we're going to move over to a legal tussle that's happening around a project that was kickstarted. So some folks related to some Star Trek things, essentially just fans of Star Trek and then fans of Dr. Seuss books, collaborated to put together a Kickstarter for a book that they were going to produce that they're calling Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go, which I think is hilarious. And they wanted to have it incorporate kind of visual elements of like Dr. Seuss things, but then also some writing in that kind of style, and then also elements from Star Trek. And they had an example that looked like it was the Gorn and Kirk kind of standing off in a very kind of Grinch versus any of the Who's, I guess. Yeah, just like, you know, I thought it was it's a fun little thing. They unfortunately ran afoul of the whatever company holding company owns the Dr. Seuss trademarks and everything, and they got a cease and desist order, which it was, I believe, a successful Kickstarter up to that point. Like, I think it had already passed the funding goal, but because there's a lawsuit involved, all of those assets are frozen. So they couldn't use the money for the lawsuit if they wanted to, and thus the project is probably dead because they don't have any way to pay for legal representation or things like that. So we found an article calling for any lawyers that have intellectual property law credits and things like that that could maybe take that case pro bono. I think I would hope they could find a Dr. Seuss / Star Trek / IP lawyer reasonably. I feel like the Venn diagram.
Yeah, there's a lot of crossover there.
You know, there might be someone in there that could help. I mean, it does seem to fall under just fair use and parody. So I don't know what the lines are about that. And apparently it's not that clear either. So it might be the kind of thing that that could be argued to be put together. I just think it's fun. I think that kind of stuff should exist out in the world. I mean, it clearly shows there's a market for it. Whether they want to get in on the royalties action or not, maybe that's their thing. It's hard to tell. It's a cease and desist, so I think maybe not. But fair use should be a thing. We'll see if that turns into anything else. Unfortunately, I had not heard of that Kickstarter. Otherwise, I probably would have backed it. I do like some Star Trek fun. Like a while ago, I joined the Kickstarter for the it was like a Chief O'Brien comic, which was pretty funny. It was just
those are great.
Like sarcastic look at the transporter chief. And his job, which was to stand at the transporter and never, like, really contribute to the episode. those were great. So I think I got the collected book that the author made of all of those, and a shirt, which unfortunately did not fit. But hey, it was a neat Kickstarter. It made it. It didn't get. Didn't get pulled. I know that they wanted to get a have the foreword be written by Cole Meany, the guy that played O'Brien, but they there was too much miscommunication before it went to press, so it ended up not happening. But it sounded like he thought it was really funny, and that's good enough for me. We're gonna stay out in space this time. We're going to talk about, instead of stuff that, you know, going out into the universe, this is something coming in, possibly coming in to hit Earth. So a new kind of software analysis engine is being fired up called NASA's Scout. And what this does is it takes image data from multiple telescopes and correlates them and kind of lines everything up, and then just checks to see if anything's moving that they don't expect. So it's meant to detect asteroids that are, the big ugly ones that you don't want. I think these are, I forget how big they end up being, but these are
ones... Bruce Willis-sized?
Sorry?
Bruce Willis-sized asteroids?
Right.
you're going to need to get a Steve Buscemi up there.
But certainly big enough that we have to worry about them. Really, I feel like we have to worry about any asteroid that's coming in. What this is meant to do is detect those asteroids, ideally when they're far enough away that we can do something about it, you know, send a Steve Buscemi up to it or whatever. But their goal is to detect 90% of those asteroids, and currently the estimate that they think they see in time is something like 25 to 30%, which is low. So a little higher would be nicer. They're essentially just graphically analyzing, you know, things over multiple spectrums, including, you know, beyond the visual, so, you know, infrared or ultraviolet or whatever, to see these things. What we do with them after we see them is something else, but project, you know, in its kind of testing phase, spotted an asteroid. I think it was like a week before it was going to come into the solar system. So that's still not a whole lot of time, but it seems like if we're going to only have a week's notice, we need to have like Steve Buscemi ready to go, like at a moment's notice. Yeah.
I feel like he's probably got a pretty quick turnaround time.
we just have to have the rocket ready to go and the big enough drill that we can do something about it.
He's not shooting Boardwalk Empire anymore, so I think he has some more free time.
Yeah, I think you know, avoiding an Armageddon kind of situation would be for the best.
I'd prefer a deep impact situation.
Definitely, definitely. We're gonna move from detection of asteroids to detection of bombs. There was a pretty attention-catching headline that I saw this week about spinach that can sniff for explosives and send you email about it. And my mind was reeling about, you know, how they would do that. You're embedding technology into plants or some kind of hybrid technology into there. And it's only sort of right, unfortunately. It's a sensationalist headline, to be sure. But what scientists have figured out how to do is that the compounds that are related to explosives are pretty well known. There are a lot of ones, but there are a lot of commonalities about certain chemical compounds, and so that's how they can do the where they swab down like your hands or your luggage at TSA, and then put it into a machine that says yes or no. Ideally, no, but it's looking for, you know, specific compounds and things like that, and so what. Some researchers had figured out a way to do is that they could make the plant react to those compounds, and then change in some way, like coloration or leaf growth or something like that, that could be noticed. Their example, the full example, was that it would pick up the chemicals by the root system, and then transfer that all the way up to the leaves in such a way that it could be picked up by a camera, and that camera would send the email. Now it takes something like 10 minutes in their example to notice it from the roots to get to the leaves in such a way that it could signal anybody, and then also you'd have to get the residue in the roots of the plant. So there's some things that need to happen before this becomes a viable system. But it is interesting in that they were able to, you know, embed things into the plants that would react to specific chemicals. Now it ends up, like I said, just being a thing that flows through the plant's essentially, you know, circulatory system to get to the leaves. So it does take some amount of time. Then you do have to have a camera that can notice it. It doesn't happen that you can just like wait and see the change. But it does make for something that maybe something not so time critical that could be embedded into plants. Something like, I don't know, maybe air quality or, presence of, you know, concentrations of chemicals in the air that would be not necessarily so urgent, you know, like, you know, the, like a bomb would be, but maybe something that you could measure over time without, without needing, to, you know, wire up electric sensors or things like that. Although when, I think, a friend, Jillian, who's been on the podcast, friend of the podcast, pointed out, she was worried that it would be, like something like they would be embedding, technology into the plants. So you would have like internet of things that you eat.
Isn't that how The Happening started?
We
don't want to have to depend on Mark Wahlberg.
Right. No, that didn't work out very well.
Give me a Buscemi over a Wahlberg any day.
Yeah. But I think that's probably not a good thing to be able to embed email capabilities into plants.
Especially when mixed with that ultrasound technology for ads.
And then we can mix that with the botnets that can go out and cause denial of service attacks. It's just all bad. You don't want your digestive system to be disrupted by a denial of service attack. That's really bad.
DDoS your colon.
More likely, it wouldn't be DDoSing your colon, because that would just be like constipation. You'd want like the traffic to flow really fast. That'd be real bad. That's not a thing either. Moving along, we're not going to stay, thankfully, in the colon. We're going to move away to something completely otherworldly. Just artificial intelligence. So IBM has been cultivating a lot of machine learning and technologies under the Watson kind of engine. You may remember Watson as the supercomputer they got to play Jeopardy. But they're betting on that technology doing a lot more than, you know, being made fun of by Alex Trebek.
He's so good at it.
Yeah.
He's my favorite troll.
Yeah. Well, the Watson AI has a lot of promise in the medical field. So one of the things that IBM did was they gave Watson access to, I think it was over 160,000 papers and research data regarding cancer treatments and symptoms and treatments and a bunch of stuff like that. And then they, after giving it all of that data, they matched it up with a bank of diagnoses that oncologists had. So those are doctors specializing in cancer research. And in, I think it was above 99% of the cases, the AI agreed with the doctors. So that's good. You don't want it to, you know, disagree wildly in what the treatments would be or what the diagnoses would be. But they went further to guess the treatments that the doctors would recommend. So based on the type of cancer and the style and things like that, there's a number of treatments available now, thankfully, and it's the kind of thing that doctors can recommend. But they had the AI recommend a bunch of them and then match those up with what the doctors recommended to see what came out of that one. And what's interesting is that I think in 30% of the cases, the AI, the Watson AI, found treatments that the doctors didn't recommend. And so that's really interesting in that, you know, doctors can only read and remember so many things, and 160,000 papers is a lot. That's a lot of data. And I think from a recommendation point of view, that's interesting because it would fill in a lot of gaps knowledge-wise about what's there. I mean, I think it still shouldn't be used in lieu of a doctor. I think a doctor obviously has to review it, and it's not necessarily that, you know, the software is infallible or anything like that. It's more that there's probably more data that can be input to the AI that isn't codifiable yet. There's nuances about, you know, treatment style and things like that that may not be something that you can just, you know, feed in as a as another piece of data. As time goes on, that'll probably get better. But in the meantime, it shows that there's a lot of potential for machine learning in healthcare. Anyway, I think that's the more, you know, we can do to make that, you know, close any knowledge gaps around that, I think is worthy. You know, I don't think that it's the kind of thing where you want to, you know, ask an AI how to treat you. You know, as anyone who's ever tried to diagnose themselves using the internet, that's all bad. That's not a thing. You immediately end up, you know, you're going to die tomorrow, essentially, if you do that. Or
I'm always going to want a human double checking.
Yeah. It wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't hurt to have a little bit of checking in there. I think the certainly having an AI as a resource would help. But again, it needs it really depends on the decisions it makes. Really depends on the data that you can give it, and the more data you can give it, the better. And so now that we've kind of determined that it can make, you know, good decisions about it, we should be trying to collect data so it can make better decisions. And that will make it kind of a better AI, not just, you know, just because it can fill in gaps, but then it should be able to identify its own gaps about what it knows and doesn't know. Known unknowns is what we're looking for. Or unknown unknowns. One of those. We should ask, I've just forgot his name. Former Secretary of Defense that said that. That was, it'll come to me later. We'll fill it in post. moving over to something completely different. There was a pretty big trial that was announced in the news this last week about male birth control. And I heard about it mostly from a snarky point of view, because it's a bi-weekly shot. I think it's every other 2 weeks. So it's a bi-weekly shot that men have to take. And then after the injection, it supposedly will, there's some amount of like a acclimation period. So for like a month, you have to get a weekly shot. And then after that, it becomes bi-weekly. And then the study had a bunch of men in it, and they were told to, you know, just do, they were all partnered men, I believe, and they had to be open to the possibility of pregnancy, but not be specifically trying to get pregnant or not get pregnant for that matter. They in order to assign like a failure rate, and then, you know, it's a regular kind of drug trial of what could happen, so they could pick up side effects and things like that. And the article that I had initially found on it on Facebook, unfortunately, but I saw it on Facebook because it had a bunch of snark in that it trial for male birth control discontinued because a bunch of men got acne, and it was saying that acne and mood swings something like that. And
only a component of it.
Yeah, right. I mean,
those are the only problems.
It's I think from one point of view, that is kind of funny and snarky. But at the same time, it was a significant number of the men that had side effects. It was something like 50% of the men tested had side effects, and there was some number, it was more than 5%, that left the trial because they had side effects of some kind. There was side effects of back pain, testicular pain, moodiness, sleepiness. Like I said, 50% of them developed some form of acne, and it was something where it's not that the side effects were necessarily overwhelming, but there were so many of them, and it goes, I guess that the incidence of side effects was above their threshold, which was something like 2%, which is really surprising to me how low that percentage is, because I feel like whenever I take medicine, it's not all the time, but whenever I feel something even remotely like a side effect, it's above, in my opinion, like a quarter of the time, like I will get a headache or dry mouth or whatever. And it's just interesting that they want the threshold to be that low about it. But 2% is, that's good. I mean, you don't want side effects. Generally, side effects are not good.
Five percent of the people in the study didn't regain their sperm counts after they stopped taking the shots.
Oh.
So they're basically sterile.
Ah.
Like, that's a major side effect. I mean, yeah, there are some of the side effects that's like, yeah, that's not that bad. And the things that women have to deal with in birth control are much worse.
Mm.
And clearly this would be an improvement over that. But the things like, oh yeah, and it's permanent accidentally.
Yeah.
Seems like a major problem.
Right, right. And so they,
and not to say they shouldn't stop testing, there shouldn't be further studies, because there definitely should be.
Yeah.
But yeah, the two things that stuck out to me the most as far as being reported were the 5% who didn't get it back, and it's 92% effectiveness while it's actually working. And then the 38% increase, the side effect was increased sex drive.
Right.
It's like, oh no.
It's increased? Oh my God. But
yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a 7.5% failure rate, as opposed to condoms, which that's really weird, because it's like, it's a 98% success rate, so a 2% failure rate if you're doing it perfectly right. Problem is, a lot of people don't do it perfectly right. Whereas getting a shot every other week, you can probably do that perfectly right, but if the you know, it's all risk versus reward, in my opinion. Got to do the math before you do the, yeah. But male birth control should be a thing. I think more options in that vein are important, given that we give, you know, it's certainly an unfair kind of distribution of burden. In that it's something that, you know, is not, I think it's not impossible, but, the amount of research into it is probably not commensurate, with making it more possible. So it's something that should be looked into, should be a thing. elsewhere for, stuff that should be a thing, Iceland a while ago, did something that we ended up not talking about on the show until this week, but they crowdsourced their constitution. They used a lot of the tools that we talked about in insert episode here, kind of related to the Occupy movement many, many moons ago, it seems, that we first started talking about that on the show. But one of the ones that came up in the Occupy movement was that it was... it had a lot of building blocks of direct democracy and really valuing participatory democracy over representative democracy, which is what most kind of folks, especially folks in the U.S., are familiar with. So representative democracy is you elect somebody, and that somebody acts on your behalf to write laws and make policies and things like that. Whereas direct democracy is everyone acts, you know, via voting or some other method to create policies and legislation and then vote them in or repeal them. And it's a much more, you know, as the name suggests, participatory kind of action. You have to actually be informed and involved in the process, or it doesn't, you know, work or make sense. Whereas with representative democracy, you can kind of be a little lazy, but then you also have to deal with whatever the outcome is. And how much do you trust the elected officials involved? This is all very timely, considering that Election Day is next week in the United States. The constitution that Iceland put together that was written in a crowdsourced model. It was pulled together by a bunch of different people and then voted on again and again and again. Different things were proposed to it and put together. It was really kind of a this grew out of the outcome of, I think, the financial system essentially completely crashing in Iceland. And so really developing, you know, what should and shouldn't be in the tenets of their constitution was something that they wanted to pull together. And so they pulled that constitution together, and the parties in power at the time when it was pulled together voted it down. And so their national elections were just this last week, and a number of political parties, they have multiple ones. It's not like the U.S. where we essentially only have two. They have a number of them. It's more than five or six even. You vote for a party preference, and then they will allocate their, I think it's parliament, I'm not sure, but they will allocate their governing body based on the percentages of that vote. So if there was 15% that got the Pirate Party, which is one of the ones that was running with the express kind of mandate to make that constitution take effect, they were running on that platform, and they got 15% of the vote, and so they will get 15% of the members of the new parliament when that gets put together. So that ended up growing their representation in the parliament from, I think it was 3 members to 10. So it's pretty significant. They ended up being the third largest political party in the body. But what was interesting was that they were favored to win by the polls. They ended up not winning, but what it meant was there was enough splitting of the votes that no party had above whatever the threshold is to be considered the ruling party. So all government has to operate as a coalition. So you have to be able to work with different parties. It's a system that sounds really interesting. Not this kind of first past the post and electoral college kind of fun that we do here in the United States. But what's really interesting is not only the Pirate Party, but a couple other parties ran with the idea that they would implement or at least reconsider the crowdsourced constitution. And that's really interesting. I think the it can show another way to kind of develop laws. And it's happening in an actual country that people have heard of and not some kind of small group which doesn't have any effect on any kind of policy. I mean, it's still just Iceland, but it's a real thing. It's a real country that most people have heard of.
Yes, it is a real country. They have people and land.
Yes.
And a flag.
Yep. Yep. And
that's what you need for a country, right?
Yeah.
You people, land, and a flag.
Mm-hmm.
No flag, no country.
Ideally, a kick-ass national anthem.
Yeah, that's good.
But it will be really interesting as that the like I said, the because the even the largest party that picked up, I think it was something like 29% of the vote, it's still less than a third of the governing body. So it means that every action has to be taken by considering other points of view, and it's very possible that the that large elements of that crowdsourced constitution gets implemented. So that's really interesting. I don't fully think that something like that could work in the U.S.
Not on the scale, not in the size of country we have, and also the size of the idiot population in our country.
I mean, it really requires a large number of people to be interested in what the outcome is. And I think there's enough apathy in the U.S. that it's just not not enough of a thing yet.
What do you think of the whole concept of everybody just get out and vote?
I
it's like just vote just to vote.
Yeah, I think it's too easy to vote in a way. Well, I mean, even if you knew what you were doing, I think it's too easy to vote in a way that is not actually in line with what you think, whether you knew it or not.
Yeah.
There's enough. I mean, just looking through the California initiatives this go around, there are a number of bills that or not bills, but a number of initiatives that are actually at odds with each other. And there are like gotchas around if this initiative wins, but wins more than this other initiative, they actually cancel each other out. And it's even from a knowledge perspective, the way that the initiatives are written is entirely confusing. Now, I think that voting is a right that's very important, and it's something that people should take seriously. But I also think there's enough, there's too much dabbling and meddling with how those things are created and publicized, and it's hard for people even that want to do the research to do it right to vote in a way that actually matches or lines up with what's created. In short, I think that, you know, if you're not informed about a thing, you probably shouldn't vote about it. But at the same time, I think you should do your best to try to actually vote, because it's important. Voting is how, or it, at least voting for the people that should represent you should be taken seriously, because those are the people that are actually going to be trying to write the laws that work with you. A lot of the initiatives are meant to be from the people, at least in California, but often are written by corporations and lobbyists, which are awful. So the initiative process is a whole other thing, which probably deserves its own show. Maybe not this show. But I do like the idea of one of the pieces of participatory democracy, at least the way that, if I'm remembering right, the way that the Occupy movement built it was that if you didn't want to vote on a thing because you were uninformed or something like that, you could not vote on it, or you could give your vote to someone that you thought would vote, you know, in a way that was like you. So it was a representative democracy kind of thing, but it was only one level. You could not give your vote to someone and then that vote or that person could give their two votes to somebody else. It was only kind of one step action. And so it was a way to kind of deal with an uninformed voter or an uninformed vote, but still keep the give the participation the weight of that participation, whether you were in control of that vote or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, voting is really interesting, and I think the different ways that that elections could be run or votes could be tallied are very kind of wide and varied, but not necessarily known by folks. I think, especially in the United States, it's very much like people understand, you know, if you get 51%, then it wins. But like if you're voting for five people out of like a field of eight, how do you deal with that? What do you do, you know, to like, do you rank your choices? Do you vote for a bunch and then see how that goes? There's a lot of ways to deal with those kinds of choices, which could do things like maybe have more than two choices, you know, two valid choices for major offices. But those are the kinds of things that are probably suppressed by, you know, large parties, large political parties and things like that. So there is a lot of fight between what people can do and what people might want to do. So there's a lot of mucking around that the system could use, in my opinion. Oh, it's fun. I don't usually talk politics at that meta of a level. It's nice. You know, I don't dig in and go, you know, for a very specific political party or anything like that. I just find that, especially, you don't want to do that on Facebook. It's a real waste of time. But but even in person with folks, it tends to be like people have generally made up their minds about a lot of things, and you can kind of talk to them about why. And I find that more interesting. Like if you can get to the meta reason of why a person wants to vote in a specific way, that's when you can actually kind of discuss like what people value and what they think can be changed and not. And that's a lot more interesting. That's the kind of discussions that I would rather have, you know, with people about political stuff. And I don't know, it's few and far between. So thanks for indulging me for a minute there. And with that, we will, if you haven't left the show yet, we'll sign off for this week. Thanks for sticking with us. And we're marching towards, you know, maybe another arbitrary number out there. But if you'd like to join us again, feel free to let us know. Tweet at us, Facebook us, let us know in person. If you can find us on Google+, please do. I can't. So, you know, but in any case, do let us know. And Brendan, I will talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.